But something bizarre started happening. Mars started to move less and less and less. Essentially, it started slowing down. Well, how could this be? Everything in the heavens is constant. So the movement should be constant because at some point it's going to go on the other side of the horizon and disappear until it comes around the backside. Because again, they all knew the Earth was round. But lo and behold, it slowed down to a point where he could not even observe it being in a different location. It effectively stopped. Which made no sense whatsoever. But then, something even more bizarre started happening. With the same speed as it was moving, it reversed directions. It started going backwards. How could that be? You're here. Everything's going around you. How could something come and suddenly go backwards? That made no sense. So this quandary perplexed him. He spent days and weeks trying to figure out what was going on. He tried doing so in an honest, true manner. Now, by the way, what motivated him was his devotion to his faith. He believed that it was every human being's duty to figure out how God made reality. In the minds of Copernicus, it wasn't about just going to church. It was about God, the greatest and wisest creator, making this planet for us to enjoy. Well, let's figure out what he has available for us. So he was attacking this not out of the desire to destroy or uproot anything. He was doing it for the most sincerest reasons. He was just trying to figure out how the damn thing worked. As he said in his book, On the Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres, and I quote, I began to be annoyed that the movements of the world machine, created up for our sake by the best and most systematic artisan of them all, were not understood with greater certainty by the philosophers, who otherwise examined so precisely the most insignificant trifles of this world. By the way, he would write a book, which in Latin is De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, which in English is On the Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres. On the Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres. It's in this book that he documented his observations. Now here's the amazing thing. He wrote his book in 1510. But he would not allow it to be published until his death. It was published posthumously. Because what, after all, happens to people who challenge the laws of the church in the 16th century? Yeah, they died. They're accused of heresy. They're burned at the stake. Not only was his book not published until he died, he also ordered that it be dedicated to the Pope. Pope Paul III, the architect of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. It was dedicated to him. But in his book, he lays out what today we regard as being the heliocentric view of reality. Once he observed Mars, he did the same thing with all of the other planets. And he suddenly realized that everything is not revolving around the earth. No, no, no. But instead, the earth is a body that is traveling in unison with the planets around another center point. He argued it has to be the sun, because the sun is constant. Every single day it comes up on one side and sets on the other. Which, seeing how it emanates light, this is how we have day becomes night. How did he come up with this? Well, in trying to figure out what he saw, he envisioned, in a brilliant stroke, the galaxy like a racetrack. If you have a racetrack, who is the fastest person on the track? What lane do they have? Or horse or car? What's the fastest lane? The inside. Why? Yeah, because it's closer to the center, right? So, imagine for me this. The Earth is on the inside lane, and Mars is on the outside lane. If both are moving at the same speed, eventually Earth is going to pull away. Thus, you're going to start getting ahead of Mars. And then, when you come up the backside, it's going to start doing this, back and forth, just like when I went to my daughter's track and field event 2 weeks ago, and there was this one runner, I think he was running for, was it Mass Maritime? I forgot what to call it, Salem State maybe? And this guy doing the long distance, he literally was two laps ahead of everybody else. So as he's running, I'm sure he sees them coming up behind, and then suddenly they're in the rearview mirror. Well, here's the problem. This was the official position of the church, that the universe was geocentric. Not this. He died. Saved his life. Dedicated the book to the Pope. Apparently the Pope was kind of curious about it, interested, but did nothing. Because other things were going on, like the Council of Trent. But amazingly, Copernicus, as this possible heretic, was not discussed at all. He was completely ignored. And, as it turns out, the church would not take an official position on heliocentrism for 60 years. It wouldn't be until the 1600s. So, think Luther. Luther started a notion that the church and the Pope are not infallible. They're not perfect. They're flawed. Why did the Protestant Reformation expand? Because the church did nothing about them. The same was true about Copernicus. Ironically, the only person from within the church out of the gates to criticize was a Dominican monk by the name of Giovanni Tolisani. He lived at the convent of St. Mark in Florence, and he wrote a book in 1545 attacking Copernicus's theory. But his book was never published. It wasn't discovered until decades later. The book was called On the Truth of the Sacred Scripture. But Tolisani's take was not scientific. He didn't refute the observations, but instead, he refuted it based on philosophical grounds. He argued, for example, that the very hypothesis that Copernicus had was flawed because it was based on assumptions. But there was no physical proof of what he was claiming. Now, of course, when later scientists investigated Copernicus, it would require a complete retooling of scientific observations, which ultimately would give birth to physics. Because Copernicus didn't know the math behind what he was saying. Others, however, would develop it. Second, he argued that Copernicus's thought process was backwards. Meaning, he came up with the outcome and then kind of fabricated everything else to get those results. Instead of starting at step one, going to two, going to three, going to four. So he went to the end and filled in the details instead of gauging the facts as they developed. Now, by the way, have any of you ever taken a class on debate? You know, one of the things that if you learn how to debate that you are taught to do is to basically dismantle your opponent's argument. And one of the easiest ways to do it is to do essentially what Tolisani did. Because Tolisani is not providing counter evidence. He's just saying, no, the other guy just made it up. Without saying, here's how. By the way, politicians do that all the time. You know, something happens because I said so. Not whether or not it's actually true. All right, questions? So we had the church potentially react, but it was never published. So as Copernicus's book was printed and began to circulate, that would result in others, not from the church, but other people trying to either refute or prove Copernicus's findings based on provable evidence. One of the first individuals to take up the mantle was Tycho Brahe. Brahe was a Danish noble who, instead of working, used his family's wealth to become one of the leading astronomers in his day. He literally built for himself an observation tower in which he could go above the ground and look up at the heavens. Ironically, Tycho would spend his entire life devoted to proving the geocentric universe. Now, as I have up here, doesn't say that he was anti-Copernicus. He admired Copernicus. He just believed that Copernicus's outcome was wrong. And he tried proving him wrong, not just saying he was wrong. Tolisani said, no, Copernicus is wrong because I said so. No, Brahe tried proving scientifically that Copernicus is wrong. For example, he engaged in a similar type of documentation. He spent 18 months watching the constellation Cassiopeia. Every single night, 18 months, whenever it was clear, wrote down, here's where the constellation is, here's where the constellation is. And you know something? It did not move. If the Earth is moving and Cassiopeia is there, would not, as the earth travels around the sun, the same thing happen to Cassiopeia as Copernicus documented in Mars? Would not it move? Well, here's the thing. The earth is a ball, and we know as it travels in its orbit around the sun, it pretty much stays upright. It doesn't tumble because it's spinning on its axis. Cassiopeia is not at the equator. Cassiopeia is a northern sky constellation. So as the Earth is spinning on its axis, it's like looking up at the heavens as you spin in place. Just FYI. He also, in his studies, observed a great comet, believed to be Halley's Comet, which traveled through the area where all the planets was. But it came and went and then disappeared and never came back. If the Earth was rotating and everything was rotating on the sun, how did this celestial comet come and just disappear? Of course, he didn't realize that we have our solar system and there's a bigger galaxy beyond. And it simply cut through our galaxy and just our solar system and left. Halley's Comet came through when I was a kid. I think it was like the 70s. And I think it comes through like every 90 years. So it's engaged on a big orbit, but it's not orbiting our sun. It's on another path. So, he's similar. He's observing things. He's documenting. But he just, his lack of understanding of the universe as a whole explains why he was getting these, what we today we would consider to be flawed results. But here's the most amazing thing. Out of all of the scientists associated with the scientific revolution, his observations are the most accurate. And some of his math would remain entrenched as factual up to the computer age. When a computer calculated that his math was off just a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. But at the end of the day, he said, nope, nope, nope. The Earth cannot be moving. Why? Simple. The Earth is too big. Look at the planets. Look up. Look how small they are. They're tiny. In comparison to the Earth, you can't see the end of the Earth. The Earth is huge. The Earth is even bigger than the Sun. So because the Earth is too big, it's no way it can be moved. It's like a mountain. You can't move a mountain. It's just too big. So for two decades, he hammered out all of the observations and calculations which would develop a really bizarre hybrid, which today is acknowledged as being a geoheliocentric universe. So, using Copernicus's observations and combining it with his own, he argued, okay, all of the other planets could be orbiting around the sun. But not the Earth. The Earth is bigger than the sun. And while all of the other planets kind of do this little funky movement, what does the sun do every single day? Starts on one side, travels through the heavens, and ends on the other. Questions? Of course, today we know the biggest flaw of his calculations was he doesn't include distance. Because what happens to something when it's far away in terms of size? It shrinks. No questions? All right, well, let's make the rubber meet the road.
the next significant individual to contribute to this changing of the perception of the universe
was a German astronomer and mathematician by the name of Johannes Kepler. Now, I know Anna Maria is a very small school, but when I was your age, I went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Thousands and thousands of people. And as a result of the number of students, it allowed for a very broad diversity of classes. And after hating my biology teacher and my chemistry teacher in high school, I decided I wanted to do another science class for my requirements. And I decided to do astronomy. In our astronomy class, day one, we started with Johannes Kepler.
Kepler, ironically, was a student of Tycho Brahe.
Like Brahe, he believed in Copernicus. But the student, working side by side with the teacher, began arguing that the teacher's model was wrong. So, due to a dispute, the student left and went out and started engaging in his own work. He simply realized that if you take Brahe's model and you simply invert it, so instead of having the sun going around the earth, but you put the earth in the model, Brahe had the math. Brahe had everything else right. But essentially, he made a twist. And if he didn't have that twist, he would have actually proved Copernicus. But of course, if you have an agenda, if you have a notion that you refuse to let go of, it's amazing how you can cloud your findings. And how did he figure this out? Well, unlike Copernicus, who studied Mars, unlike Tycho, who studied constellations, Kepler studied the paths and documented of every single planet that was known of at the time. Mercury all the way to Saturn. And in doing something, he actually devised the equation that proved mathematically Copernicus was 100% right. I still have all my notebooks. This is the equation that was on the first couple of pages. Apparently, at that point, I could tell you exactly what it meant. Today, it's like Swahili. I have no clue. But essentially, what this does is you can plug in the average estimated distance of the planet from the sun into this equation, and you can get out a quantifiable result. And it's true for every single planet. But you know what this result proves? Not that we travel around the sun in a sphere. No. He actually discovered all of the bodies are moving around the sun in an ellipse. He found that the planets change speed depending upon where in the orbit they are. So, as the planet is going around the corner, it's traveling at its fastest distance, or fastest speed. But then it kind of slows down as it gets into the straightaway. But then as it gets into the corner again, it begins speeding up until it's slingshotted and slowly slows down until it speeds up again. If when you were in high school, if you had a physics, bless you. I'm sure maybe your physics teacher had you take like a nut, a metal nut, put it on a string and spin it. You know, it's the same thing. When you put the force on it and it's closest to you, it speeds up until it kind of lags until you jerk it around again.
Oscillation.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Science. But the biggest thing was what I already said.
Not only did Kepler give the math that Copernicus lacked,
but he created an equation that anybody who refuted or challenged the idea could use and come up with the same results. So, science fiction suddenly became science fact. Questions? But that was all going up in the heavens. The man responsible for bringing it all together was an Italian astronomer, physicist, and engineer from the city of Pisa, man by the name of Galileo Galilei.
Galileo
would be the one who would argue that mathematics is the language of nature.
God, in creating reality, did things through processes that could be calculated. And once you figure out the math, you can begin experimenting and possibly get different results.
Now, one of his biggest arguments is that just as you can observe universality in the heavens, the same is true on Earth. Nature here is uniform. It's not random. If we're sitting in this classroom, boom, a 10-foot tall oak tree isn't going to suddenly magically appear. You know, as much as I could dream of one, a Chick-fil-A sandwich is just not going to be in my hand. Things just don't happen. But rather, things are processes. So, I'm sure you're familiar with some of his experiments. He went up to the Tower of Pisa and had two balls made of the same material. One was bigger than the other. Went to the edge and let them go. Which one's going to get to the ground faster? How many people think the bigger one? How many people think the smaller one? How many people think it's going to be a tie? In fact, you're right. They're made of the same stuff. Size doesn't matter. They're still going to be pulled to gravity at the same rate. Now, of course, this was contrary to what Aristotle taught. Science said bigger means faster. Speed was in direct proportion to weight. But Galileo proved no. Speed is in direct proportion to mass. And everything moves at the same speed when falling, if it's the same mass. Was it like 9.83 meters squared per second or something like that? I don't know, that was something I learned in high school. I don't remember the numbers. Actually, I had it in college too. But my God, that was in the 80s. That was a long time ago. Oh, and he didn't just theorize. He used observation and documentation and quantification. And he would prove that Copernicus was 100% accurate. But in 1610, he would get himself into a little bit of trouble, because he wrote about it and published a book called The Starry Messenger. Although I was kind to you, for some reason I don't have it in Latin. Sidereus Nuncius, The Starry Messenger. In it, he described his observations because he was clever. He, instead of looking up at the sky with a naked eye, would use a telescope. Now, we're not sure who invented the telescope, but there are documented appearances that go back to the 1300s. But Galileo took what was available and improved it. The original telescopes could only increase the size of something 2.5 times. But Galileo realized, instead of using a solid lens, if you curve the edges, like the human eye, what that ends up doing, when you look in this way, it magnifies the image that you see. And if you add multiple lenses, you can expand. In the end, his telescope could increase the magnification by 20 times. You looked at it, something looked 20 times larger than it was. And you know what? With that, he was the first human being ever to live to observe that Jupiter had moons and that Saturn had rings. He saw the movement of weather patterns on Venus. And, most extraordinary, he drew images of the moon's surface. All of his observations, however, were aimed at proving heliocentrism. Now the problem is, he was writing in Rome. And once his book was published, he got on the radar of the Holy Office, the Roman Inquisition. Why?
Because in work after work after work, he began arguing that there was no distinction between earth and heaven. Meaning, the realm of the gods is not real. That just as you can calculate with precision what's happening here, the same is true above. So to put it another way, the earth is just a small piece in a grander universe.
The heavens are not special, neither is the third rock from the sun. He became a household name for all the wrong reasons. And then, as he's getting into it, getting himself into trouble more and more, he stepped in it, big time. In 1632. But as I like to say, he was a victim of circumstance. In 1632, the Pope, who knew about Galileo, knew about his works, knew about his theories, asked him to write a book. What he wanted Galileo to do is to write in a single book all of the arguments, or at least explain them, for heliocentrism and against. to which Galileo humbly accepted. Now, in his book, he was very careful on his wording. He did not want the reader to be able to tell what his own opinions were. He tried being as impartial and right up the middle as you could. But the Pope, not being a humble man, Urban VIII, asked Galileo to put the Pope's own views into the book. Kind of like, well, the Pope says this. To which Galileo said, okay. But then the Pope said, don't say it comes from me. I want to see if the readers can figure out. It's my position. To which he did. The book is called The Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. And it was written in the form of an old Roman dialogue. Any of you ever read any of Plato's works? So you have speakers that, you know, it's just not the author saying, I said this, I said, it happens through conversations, characters. So there were different characters making arguments for the different theories. The character which Galileo put in place to argue the Pope's ideas was a character by the name of Simplicio. Simplicio. Now, this was done to honor the Pope because Simplicio was actually a 6th century Christian philosopher by the name of Simplicius. But Italian had broken away from the traditional Latin. So Simplicio is the Italian version of the Latin name Simplicius. Now, unfortunately, Simplicio is very similar to the Italian word sempliciotto, which is the Italian word for simpleton. So, people who read the book began to ridicule the Pope as being a simpleton. In other words, a moron. Needless to say, the Pope didn't take too kindly. Oh, by the way, the same thing happens all the time. You know, we have a cancel culture, the mob mentality. People hear one thing and they lose their minds instead of taking the time to actually kind of figure out the meaning behind it. I'm sure you've observed those situations in your life. Well, the mob went crazy. The Pope was outraged when people came to him and said, Your Holiness, Galileo's mocking you. And as a result, he would be pulled before the Holy Office, the Roman Inquisition. And he would be put on trial. Now, FYI, this was the second trip that Galileo had before the Inquisition. He got himself in trouble in 1616 for the Starry Messenger. During the trial, he was accused and found guilty of, look how it's phrased, of being guilty of vehemently, strongly, suspected of heresy. So not that he actually committed heresy, but a reasonable person could think that he was committing an act of heresy. Now, by the way, there's myths out there that he was tortured, but I've never found any actual first-hand historical evidence to prove it. Instead, all of the primary sources say he was forced to recant. He had to denounce all of his life's work. Ironically, the Pope was happy with that because of what had been going on with other heretics who were burned at the stake. They were made martyrs. And the last thing Urban wanted to do was have Galileo be a martyr. So he would spend the rest of his life locked in a house, under house arrest, not allowed to write anything. And all of Galileo's books would be collected, locked in a vault in Rome, and would remain under lock and key for about 100 years. It was not until 1741 that Pope Benedict XIV allowed Galileo's works to be published. And he removed the guilty charge 120 years after the guy died. Questions? Right. 10:40. I'm trying to remember what time we finished. Good, we got enough time for the last two guys I want to talk about.
Sir Isaac Newton
was an Englishman. He, like the other scientists, got into science through mathematics, but he also would contribute to the development of physics as well as astronomy. What Newton did was bring together the math of Kepler and the ideas of Galileo. He would write many books that were published in the 17th and early 18th centuries. And I'm sure when you were in high school, you probably learned or read little excerpts of Principia Mathematica or Optics. But in totality, in all his works, he was one of the first people to argue, essentially, that the only limitation to understanding the universe is your own eyes. Because, in fact, the universe is infinite. It goes on and on and on. And no matter where in the universe you are, it all functions the same. Existence is governed by laws. Laws that can be quantified mathematically. What's one of his most famous experiments? Well, we got the laws of motion, but his experiments. It was Newton who first proved that even the light itself is made up of tiny particles. And you can rip light apart by taking a prism of glass and shining a light source through it, and it will break it apart to the different bands that make up the light that we see. And he could make the bands with mathematical precision, based upon the angles of the prism. And no matter the light source, you'd get the same results. Over and over again, the same results. He also devised an entirely new philosophy of nature, which I talked about in the beginning. Everything in nature is structured the same. Everything is made of matter. Matter is always there. When you die and they put you in the ground, you may decompose as all the moisture leaves your body and you dry out. But even if you get to the stage of being dust, the matter that you're made of still exists. That dust does not cease to be. It may blow in the wind, but the particles are there. And like I said, what's the distinction between you and the chair? The atomic structure. The chair has different particles than you. A lot of the same, but a lot of difference. And it's the arrangement in you that makes you alive, and that not the chair.
And that everything is held together through a force. He also, as Rama alluded to, developed the laws of motion.
Inertia. Love inertia. I love inertia so much, I've been doing this since I used to teach middle school. Look at it. Look at it. It's not moving. It's not moving. Nope, 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 nope. There's a body at rest. What? Yeah, body at rest, stays at rest until an external force acts upon it and makes it move.
The speed of that thing is in direct relation to the force. The more force you put behind it, the faster it goes.
And for every action, there is a counter-reaction, an equal and opposite force. Everything gets pushed and gets pulled back. He also developed what today we call gravity, although he referred to it as universal gravitation. In it, he argues that every object that's in existence is attracted to other objects in proportion to the force that acts upon it. So, there's a force in me, there's a force in you. What stops us from smashing up against each other? Well, it's my force kind of keeping ourselves apart, but at the same time, it's pulling us together. Or more precisely, it's the reason why me and gravity is so tight. I have no rise. That's about as high as I can go. Why? Because gravity keeps pulling me down. Tight like that.
Essentially, Newton would blow the doors off of the church. And in no way, shape, or form could the old ways be sustained. Because point after point after point, he proved things. He gave equations. Equations that could be copied and replicated and reused. And essentially, he would give rise to the perception of reality that we have today. Some books, your textbook may refer to it as being the Newtonian world machine. It's all thanks to this man synthesizing the works of everyone who came before him. Questions? All right. Last point, and this is where we're going to end. Because I don't have time to talk about these next three guys.
Here is the kicker, though. The scientists, as important as they were, would not be known as they are today if there were not individuals willing to champion science, to advocate for these new ideas. Because these scientists would change the world, change the truth, change the facts. And let's be honest, people have a tendency to get set in their ways. And human beings by nature don't like new ideas. They don't like counterpoints because they're afraid, bless you, they're afraid they might be wrong. So when presented with new ideas, they resist. Think of the church and the Inquisition. If you said something the church disagreed with, you could be burned alive. But men like the three that we're going to talk about on Thursday, they were ones willing to put their lives on the line, arguing simply that the ideas of the scientists, that's the truth. And as human beings, we should not delude ourselves with our own agendas, our own ideas. But instead, we should only focus on the truth. And by the way, who can study the truth? Anybody. Anybody. And in doing so, all human beings have the ability to make lives better. That human existence can progress.
Regardless of the implications. But it's not always easy.
Not always easy. Have you ever been yelled at, screamed at, because you had an idea that went against somebody else's? Well, it takes a bold man or woman to stand up on principle. And these were three that would. We'll deal with that on Thursday. So I'm done with you. Papers, 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 if I haven't said that already. At this point, hopefully you've conducted your research. Hopefully you're at the point of writing it. I mean, I know you got other classes, but at least for my class, we're not dealing with anything else until May. So if you want to get it in quick, be my guest. And of course, if there's any questions you have on any of the things on prophetmanic.com, do not hesitate to ask. Heck, I even proved that I'm kind of like an IT guy earlier today, so it all works out. Enjoy the weather. We'll see you on Thursday.